Hey everybody, I'm Kyle Risdahl. Welcome back on a Wednesday to Make Me Smart, where we make today and every day make sense.
And not just any Wednesday, it's What Do You Know? What do you want to know Wednesday? What do you want to know Wednesday? And I'm Kimberly Adams, trying to get the words out of my mouth on Wednesday in order. What do you want to know Wednesday?
I
day in the week where we get
so
to answer your questions.
I want to know so many things. Okay, Caitlin in Chicago gets us going today. We don't waste time around here, man. We get right to
we
it.
Really
we got 15 minutes. We got a boogie. Caitlin in Chicago, go.
I have a question for you guys about young professionals and what their careers will look like post-pandemic. So right now, I'm an engineer working for a large healthcare company in the Chicago area. Mm-hmm. But post-pandemic, I feel like I really need to take a kind of sabbatical. So I've accepted a job with an outdoor travel company, and I start in 2 weeks.
Wow.
I'm curious, are there other young professionals also looking to make career changes or pauses or pivots? Any data you have would be appreciated. Thanks for making me smart.
Yeah. Yeah. People are.
I love that for you.
I know. That's so cool.
I love that for you.
That's so cool. I honestly, this is not an answer to the question, but I'm a tad bit jealous of the people who can right now, for whatever reasons in their life, do this. Because if ever there was a time to do it, this is the time to do it. You are absolutely not alone, Caitlin, right? I mean, we talked about this on Marketplace the other day, this thing called the quits rate. People are leaving their jobs in this economy at rates not seen like ever.
Ever.
And it's not just like pure data. There are psychologists and behavioral economists who will tell you that people are leaving because they want to change, because 15 months of being locked down is absolutely causing them to rethink their priorities, you know?
Or 15 months working as an essential worker when you had to be out in it is making you recognize that if there are other options available, you will take them. And I don't, it's not just young workers, it's workers in general. I think young workers, you know, depending on your definition of young, some of us are young at heart. I'm not going to date myself here. But I think a lot of workers had some time to sit and think about their life choices and are making different decisions. Or they got used to working remotely and they don't want to go back to full-time work and their employers want them to come back. There are so many things feeding in at once. There are also workers in industries that already had a particularly high rate of turnover that didn't get to do that turnover during the pandemic. And so some of that is just sort of filtering through. But yeah, the typically high turnover industries like retail and warehousing, food service, quitting in large numbers, and then people who actually have a little bit more higher skills, now they recognize that they like living in St. Louis, Missouri instead of Silicon Valley, and they want a job that allows them to keep doing that.
Yeah, for sure. And it's, look, it's blue collar and white collar. I think this is one of those across the labor force kind of phenomena that are going to be playing out for a long time. I really think that's true. But good on you for going, man. Holy cow. A little scary, but cool.
I would love to hear an update on how it goes.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Totally. That's exactly right. Yep.
Yes. All right, and our next question comes from John in Boise, and it's a voice memo. Thank you, John.
John in Boise, Idaho here. John. I don't want to sound like your run-of-the-mill mid-90s comic, but what's the deal with gas prices? Or more specifically, what's the deal with all the hullabaloo surrounding gas prices?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I have two thoughts on this. Number one— gas prices are the only prices in this economy that smack you in the face driving down the road in 19-inch high letters every single day. You can't not see these prices, right? Gallon of milk, got to go into the store, figure out what it's going to cost you. A loaf of bread, whatever, right? Gas prices are right there up at you. Also, just as a sort of an economic indicator kind of thing, I think it's always interesting to look at oil prices and where they're going and see gas prices go up. And as we've talked about on Marketplace, right, gas is above 72. Goldman Sachs says it's going to 80, still far from the highs, by the way. So it's not just what's up with gas prices. It's like a real thing, you know? It's a real thing.
Yeah, and it's such a volatile number.
Oh, yeah.
It goes up and down so quickly. I mean, when the Suez Canal situation was happening, that had an impact on it. When the pipeline had the ransomware, that had an effect on it. And so there are so many things that can move that number so dramatically that a lot of economists, when they're trying to look at inflation, they don't even include energy prices because it's just messy.
Yep.
But this is the number that your mind kind of jumps to when you think of inflation. And I actually talked to some economists about this a few months ago because you and I were discussing in the editorial meeting, like, my sister saw the gas prices and she's like, oh, is this the inflation that you were talking about? And I was like, no, absolutely not. But the economists and behavioral scientists do, our brains do something with the numbers that we see, just like you said. And so it kind of gives a different picture of inflation, but it doesn't mean it, you know, hurts your pocketbook. Aw, that was Southern of me. It doesn't hurt your wallet. Digital wallet, online bank statements, any less.
Totally, totally. Gas prices are a real thing, both in substance and in psychology. Okay, so we talked about voting rights restrictions yesterday on the Tuesday Deep Dive show. And as part of that conversation, I had a conversation about the money behind a lot of these laws. And here is a voice memo about that.
Henry here from the amber waves of grain in the Midwest.
Okay.
I was wondering if you could make me smart about campaign finance, specifically dark money, super PACs, and super donors. Where does all this money go? And how is this different than bribery?
Yeah.
Thanks. Love the show.
Wow. I love your energy, Henry.
No joke. Holy cow. Holy cow.
It's like... I would like to have that brand of coffee, please.
All right. You want to comment on this one? Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. And I should say about that conversation, I heard from a lot of people on Twitter who were giving examples of other groups that were being targeted by, you know, voter suppression efforts. And I know I emphasize Black voters a lot, but yes, absolutely. Native American, Latinx voters, rural voters, and just all over the place. It's not just one group. It's just it's happening all over the place.
Yep.
But to answer Henry's question, it's funny that he wants us to make him smart about something that is literally designed to be difficult to understand. Mm-hmm. Pointing everybody to a really good conversation you and Molly had with Sheila Krumholtz on the show. I'm sure it's going to be in the show notes. She's with the Center for Responsive Politics, and they go deep into this data. Dark money is talking about spending that is literally meant to be secret. It's money that comes from donors that don't have to disclose to the FEC, the Federal Elections Commission, how much money they're giving, who they are, and all these things. So you have PACs and super PACs that allow people with a lot of money who want to influence politics to kind of funnel these money, this money through organizations that don't have to point back and say, this is a person who gave us money. If you give money to a political candidate, they have to tell the Federal Elections Commission and therefore everyone in media who looks at this stuff and, you know, watchdog groups, this is who we gave money to in this amount. So dark money and PACs and super PACs can allow wealthy donors and corporations, because apparently corporations are people, to go above and beyond the normal campaign contribution limits through these groups. Additionally, if you can also run some money through political parties in a different way that allows you to get more money in. And so it's really complicated. Listen to the Sheila Krumholtz thing, but how's it different than bribery? I'm going to put on my hopeful face again from leftover from yesterday that it is technically about spending money on issues as opposed to candidates. And technically, it's not bribery unless you can really, really prove that someone like gave you a favor in exchange for the money and not an ambassadorship or something, because apparently those don't count. But
two, maybe three things about this. Number one, let's remember that the Supreme Court has ruled for a very long time now that political spending is speech and thus protected by the First Amendment. Point number two, as Kimberly alluded to, Citizens United in 2010 kind of opened the floodgates for corporations, also organized labor and many other groups to exercise those same political speech rights as individuals have. And that's when it kind of all blew wide open. And number three, with some of these groups, the catch is that you can spend as much as you want, but you're not allowed to coordinate with candidates or campaigns. That, of course, is honored mostly in the breach, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist to look and see that coordination is actually happening. But that's the legal fiction that allows this not to be bribery, but instead political speech. And I was going to make one more point. Oh, yeah. So where does
the
this money go?
Thing.
Yeah. Well, where does this money go? It goes to organizing. It goes to advertising. It goes to all of those things that make people vote one way or the other. It comes in and it goes out as just straight up political spending, because that's what it is. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, and on the super donors question, there's this report out by Issue One, which is a nonpartisan group that tries to reduce the influence of money in politics. They looked at all these donors, and 12 mega donors, at least 8 of whom are billionaires, contributed a total of $3.4 billion to federal candidates and political groups since 2009. And very helpfully, our producers did the math. That means that those 12 mega donors and their spouses, a total of 19 individuals, accounted for one out of every $13 in federal politics between January of 2009 and December of 2020. Surprise, surprise, all 12 of them are white people, which tells you a little bit about who's financing a lot of American politics and whose interests are being represented.
Right, which you can see, frankly, in the policies that are being made and the votes that are being taken, or, you know, mostly not being taken, actually. Okay, last one.
Oh, except for a vote on Juneteenth, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll do that another day.
We'll do that another day. All right. So here's one that's all you, Ms. Adams. Comes from Michael in Ontario, and here's what he wants to know. It's an email. So, Kimberly, have you been watching The Expanse? I don't even know what that is.
That's very on brand for you, Kai.
Once again, Kai's the punching bag in this podcast.
Exactly. That's okay. You know all things beer, and I don't. The Expanse is this sci-fi show that's set in, you know, of course, the future, where humans have colonized both Mars and the moon, and there's all sorts of like floating colonies and cities and things like that in the solar system. But a lot of sort of imagine taking a Charles Dickens approach to space, where there's very clear social stratification, political dynamics, lots of really poor people struggling, but add space. It's a good show. I've watched the first season. I'm into the second. I watched the first season and stopped, and then I started rewatching amongst my various binges in the pandemic, but I haven't caught up to it lately. So I would love to hear if people think I should keep it up. So, do you like any space shows?
I like a lot of I'm not as big a space person as you are, but I like a lot of space stuff. And that is the only thing that would make me watch this, I think, because, you know, dystopia doesn't do it for me. So I might try.
Yeah, it's not so much dystopia as you watch it and you're just like, yeah, it probably would end up like that, wouldn't it?
Oh, God. Great. All right. What do you want to know? Wednesday is in the books. Back tomorrow. For Thursday. In the meanwhile, please send us your questions, your comments, emails, and voice memos. It all works for us. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Let's go.
I'm not even going to ask you to watch the show because we know how that goes.
I know.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Grace Rubin is our intern, and today's program was engineered by the just back from vacation, Drew Jostad.
Nice. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Donna Tam is the senior producer of this podcast. Bridget's kind of bopping in and out, but, you know, she'll be back eventually soon.
Bopping Bridget. I can, like, imagine her in the poodle skirt and everything.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.